finally almost here. Southern Illinois is expecting an onslaught of visitors this weekend ahead of Monday's total solar eclipse. We check in with business owners in Carbondale and Murfreesboro to hear about their last-minute preparations. Plus,
astronomy is looking at the universe over and over and over again and seeing new events and different events and trying to understand what the cosmos is all about.
What happens when black holes collide? We get a down-to-earth explanation of some of the most violent and energetic processes in the universe. And we revisit our conversation with Chicago singer-songwriter Dan Durley. Here's a preview of his new album, Stone Feet.
I know I got no money, but I got all of you. And I'm working on a lot of things, I guess I don't know what to do. I got too much to think about, doing too much.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next.
Holes in my pockets, one pair of shoes.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. In just a moment, we're going to go to Southern Illinois ahead of Monday's total solar eclipse. Tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people could pile into the region. We'll talk with two area business owners about whether they're ready at this point. But first, a quick update on a story we talked about earlier this week on the 21st. Andy Kang explained the Illinois Trust Act. It's a bill that's designed to limit the ways local law enforcement in Illinois can work with federal immigration agents. Kang is legal director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago, helped write the bill. When we talked on Tuesday, he told us the governor was on board with the Trust Act.
We had really productive conversations with him all throughout the spring. And this summer, his team did confirm that he is committed to signing it. So that's our expectation, that he will be signing this bill.
But Governor Rauner's office told the 21st after that show that the bill is, quote, under review. And this morning, WBEZ Public Radio in Chicago asked the governor if he's going to sign the Trust Act. Host Tony Sarabia asked three different times, never got a clear answer. But here's the governor's last response.
But are you leaning toward signing it? Is this something that you can...
Well,
I'll
say this. I think it seems very reasonable. I think it does not tie law enforcement's hands. It actually encourages communication between local law enforcement and federal immigration facilities, and it's supported by the immigration community and the business community. So it seems like a reasonable compromise.
Governor Rauner did say he'd make an announcement in the next few days. He has until August 28th to sign the Trust Act into law or to veto it. You can learn more about the Trust Act, what's in it, and some of the reasons behind it at our website at 21stshow.org. Many people are already making their way to Southern Illinois ahead of Monday's total solar eclipse. Tens of thousands, at least, are expected in the region. They're one of the best viewing spots in the country for watching Monday's eclipse. On Monday, we'll talk with some of the people in town for the big event here from a reporter in Oregon, where the eclipse will first be visible within the continental United States. That's all on Monday's show. Today, though, we want to head back down to Southern Illinois, joined by two business owners there in the Carbondale area. On the line from downtown Carbondale is Steve Payne, owner of Quattro's Deep Pan Pizza. Steve, welcome to the 21st.
How are we doing today?
Doing all right. Are you there in the restaurant? I hear you in the background noise getting ready already.
No, I'm out in the field here. We're preparing for Shadow Fest.
Ah, okay. All right. Well, let's hear about that here in a minute. But joining us also on the line from Murfreesboro, it's about 10 miles or so northwest of Carbondale, Lisa Malheur, owner of Malheur Orchard Store and Bakery. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Steve, you're out there preparing for this event. What did you say was a Shadow Fest?
This is one of the two entertainment areas in Carbondale. Shadow Fest is one of them. I couldn't even tell you what the other name was. It's in the other end of downtown. These events run. Shadow Fest is more rock and roll tribute bands, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
The other area is a little bit more family entertainment and things of that nature.
And all areas, I assume, that are going to be, you know, hopping pretty good here over the weekend, huh?
We're anticipating a fairly large crowd. I mean, it's sheer speculation just by the amount of housing that's built up in the area. Even the day trippers on Monday with the Amtrak train coming down with 700 or 800, best that I could figure out.
And you know,
it is going to be a hopper.
Yeah. Remind us too, what's the population of Carbondale?
I believe our sign says 20 some thousand.
And they're talking anywhere from 100 to 250. Maybe some estimates showed as high as maybe 500,000 people coming into town. Although, like you said, we won't really know.
I think our area will hope that does not happen.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of that. I mean, so your pizza place located downtown, I mean, you talked there about the crowds and kind of what we can expect. What have the past few weeks been like in terms of kind of getting ready for this? Are you ready?
I think we're as ready as anything. The municipality has spent a lot of time and resources over the last 2 years. Every not-for-profit in town has been doing their darndest to try to raise the banner of hospitality as best as possible for that many potential people. We are also merging with a back-to-school at the university here also this weekend.
So Southern Illinois University move-in day was what, today, tomorrow?
They moved it up to Tuesday and Wednesday.
Oh, they moved it up, okay.
Wednesday, Thursday, somewhere around that ballpark.
But ahead of the eclipse traffic, huh?
Yes. So we've got a full complement of kids that are going to be in here for partying and need something to do.
Yeah.
So we expect a fairly robust area here with lots of the university has a literal carnival that they have brought in for student entertainment for all those kids that are captive here through this weekend. But the area will most likely be very fluid.
Yeah. Hey, Lisa, curious, I mean, what are you seeing in your area right now? What is this? Are you seeing people right now? You're a little bit further outside of town, you know, a little bit away from that university and stuff. Are you seeing any difference at this point, or is that expected later on over the weekend?
We haven't really seen an increase in traffic until today. Today, I would say we're kind of hopping and popping, and I think some of that's local business that we would normally have on a Friday. But I know driving around in Carbondale, things seem to be getting a little bit busier and more hectic.
Yeah, I know we reached out to some of the schools in the area just to see if we could talk with them on Monday while the students are in class. They all said, no, schools are closed. You know, they're not even going to try to get around. The buses aren't going to try to get through town. It's just that traffic is going to be pretty intense. So, Lisa, how have you been getting ready? I mean, what sort of planning and preparations have you been making?
Well, we've just been trying to gear up as far as, because we have peaches now, we're an orchard, and we just started, we're ending our peach season but beginning our apple season. So we're just trying to have as much product as we can, but that's such a dicey thing with fresh peaches because I can't store them up for weeks and weeks.
Yeah, it's not like you can order boxes of them.
Within a week's time. But for the bakery, yeah, we've been peeling and freezing so that we're ready to throw things in the oven and bake as people come in and ask for them, which they've been doing quite a bit this morning already, getting their cobblers, whether they're having family get-together or just a normal Friday evening.
Well, yeah, and I wonder, I mean, as you say, the traffic's a little bit higher today. You're starting to notice a bit of a difference from a usual Friday. Are people coming in and you're talking, are they from out of town? Are they from around the country? What sort of folks are you seeing?
Right. This morning, mostly what I've seen are locals. I can't say I've seen anybody from out of town. We fielded quite a lot of phone calls about it, though, during the week and kind of wanting to know what we have available. We have a number of friends, acquaintances, let's say customers that come from all over the state down here to the orchard anyway.
Yeah.
And we're looking to drop in during the eclipse weekend. So we've just reassured them that we're ready for them as much as we can. Like Steve said, it's hard to prepare for something like this. We have no clue, really. Could be 12 people, could be 200. Hard to know.
Yeah, it is hard to know. And Steve Payne, owner of Quattro's Deep Pan Pizza in Carbondale, the voice you just heard there was Lisa Malure, Malure Orchard in Murfreesboro. Steve, Lisa was talking there about the peaches, and it's hard to store some of those things, fresh produce, things like that. Well, you can stock up on cheeses and sauces and things like that. I mean, how much cheese have you ordered for this weekend?
We're at about 2 tons right now.
How does that compare?
It's about probably double what we would normally stock in. The other pleasant part is that, I mean, Carbondale's not the only one on the eclipse belt, so to say, across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So the majority of my food vendors are seeing this as a large gathering here, so to say, of consumption. So most of them are going to be delivering on Saturday and Sunday. So our supply chain, which was fearful earlier, is probably going to be a nothing now. We'll have ample supplies. We can only produce so many things. I think that's the same MO for most restaurants on here. You have production constraints, and you produce as much as you can produce. And
so maybe you only have so many workers and so many ovens and frankly, so many seats, too, that while this is a big business opportunity for many, there's only so far that can go.
Exactly. And that'll be the challenge here of local vendors providing food for this many people for this is an extended duty cycle. When we've had Halloween events and things in the past, having a 5 or 6 hour duty cycle of an evening or something is fairly manageable for one day. But when you run a 3 day event and the duty cycles have a tendency to be 12 or 14 hours, that's a real challenge on facilities on there and making sure that everybody's got enough to go around because everything comes in bursts. everybody wants to eat lunch at lunchtime. Everybody wants to eat dinner at dinner time. And with this many people, regardless of what, how high the number goes, it's going to be a little challenging, and it's going to be warm. So there's going to be a little testiness going on, to say the least. And hopefully we can just encourage people to, you know, chill out, relax, and well, everybody will get it. Get taken care of eventually.
Yeah, eventually. You know, and I wonder, just this is for both of you, I suppose, but Steve, just being there in Carbondale, you know, we're talking here obviously about sort of the business and people coming in and the preparations and the planning and that type of thing. You know, what have you seen in terms of, I know, Steve, you also work with the local commerce group there on the through the downtown area. In terms of safety and preparations, things like that, have those plans been pretty much put into place as best they can?
Very much so.
Well,
jump in there. Go ahead.
Yeah, Lisa, please go ahead.
Well, I have discussed this. You know, we kind of felt out the chief of police here in Murfreesboro, and I feel pretty confident that they've got a handle on it. I know they are pretty well staffed over the 3 days, and so I think as best as you can handle crowds of this size, I think they're going to try to make their best effort, and I think they will.
Yeah, succeed. There's been a lot of planning in it. And Steve, you said you were seeing similar things.
I'd say ditto to that. And this has been long term in planning, and fairly large crowds are not untypical in a college community on peak days, homecomings, things of that nature. So I think that our local municipality is bringing out all hands on deck. My understanding, talking to the mayor, that all the city staff is mandatory requirement to be working all weekend, and that's to take care of water services, any failures that go on, the trash pickup. Our municipality handles trash, so to have those guys out and keeping things from building up and getting messy, just trying to live up to what hospitality can be with all the logistics that go along with that.
Yeah, under the circumstances. All right, well, you've got a couple minutes here, but let's talk food. Lisa, you know, you're there, you said you had the orchard, you mentioned the peaches, preparing on that. What's the most popular item there for you guys?
Well, we serve peach cobbler and homemade ice cream every weekend anyway, so that is my most popular item. We do a few other things. And for Monday, we're going to have food offered, like Italian beef sliders and munchy food, you know, poppers and stuff like that we don't normally serve. But, yeah, to, you know, grab a plateful. And like I said, we've got plenty of open fields out here and encouraging people to just bring their chairs and, you know, pop-up tents if they want and sort of camp out for the duration and, you know, be in a safe environment where they're not blocking traffic or anything like that. And I'll have plenty of desserts. We invented a new dessert for the day called
the Peach
Eclipse.
I'm sorry, what's it called?
Well, it's called the Peach Eclipse.
The Peach Eclipse.
And, and we've got commemorative glasses to go along with it. So a little souvenir they can take home with them from the day. And
so what a Peach Eclipse is?
Well, it's going to be pound cake interspersed with layers of fresh sliced peaches, blueberries, and whipped cream.
Oh, wow. Okay. Is this a one-time only thing?
I think so. Yeah.
All right. Steve, how about you?
Fresh sliced peach.
Yeah, go ahead, Lisa.
Fresh sliced peaches take a little bit of time to get ready. I'm telling you, we worked. You know, the other ones for cooking, you know, I can freeze those peach, slice them up ahead of time and freeze them. But anytime you serve fresh sliced peaches, that's a here and now thing. You can't really, you know, get too far ahead on your preparation there.
I know there's only a limited amount you can do and things, but in terms of how many you prepare or are preparing, I guess, ahead of Monday, is it different? Is there a different level? You're going to have more prepared than usual?
I think we're tripling our production for a normal weekend. And Monday, we would never be cooking on a Monday, but we're going to treat it like as if we had an event out here and cook quite a bit.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Prepare for anyway.
Steve, how about you? What are some of your most popular items? You said you have, a ton of cheese or something like that?
Well, obviously, being a pizza place, we'll be moving a lot of pizzas and items that way. But a lot of salads because it's going to be warm.
Yeah.
That's always a big push. The pizza will be the major pusher for us. And we're just prepared from sort of dawn to dusk, staffed up as best you can, especially with long duty cycles.
Yeah.
As Lisa said, it's the same problem we do a lot of scratch-made items, so you can only prepare so much of that fresh items ahead of time, and you just hope that you've done a good enough job that you don't have to tell somebody no.
So, Lisa, you know, you mentioned the peaches, you mentioned sort of preparing everything. Come Monday, around 1:15, 1:20, everyone's going to be looking up. Where are you going to be? I hope you're not in the kitchen peeling peaches.
We're going to close the kitchen for about 20 minutes there during the 10 minutes before and after the totality, just so all of my staff can go out in the parking lot and gaze up
and
enjoy something that, you know, I know we're going to see another one in 7 years, but we're all pretty excited about this. Most of us have never been even near an eclipse. So
yeah, something like that. Pick up your pie by 1 o'clock to get out of the kitchen there. Steve, how about
we're
you?
We're going to be open from 11 to 3, you know, for all the food and stuff. So there's plenty of time
in there. And Steve, how about you? I mean, you're gonna have people sitting there, I'm sure, at 1:15, 1:20 Monday afternoon. What are your plans for that moment?
Well, we're going to try to do a very split action section to be able to let all of our staff sort of wander out for a minute. There's a quick order drill there. And shift back, keep people going, because it's, in our world, it's hard to close the shop up when you've got a lot of things in progress and motion on here. When the pizza oven's running, it's pretty hard to shut it off.
Yeah, no,
at that moment on here. So
can only imagine.
And we'll probably have most of the folks in the restaurant at the time when it gets there want to go stand over the rail and look out.
Customers, workers, everything else. Steve Payne, owner of Quattro's Deep Pan Pizza in Carbondale, Lisa Malure, or Malure Orchard in Murfreesboro, Southern Illinois, right along the path of totality. Good luck. Have fun on Monday, and I appreciate the time today.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Up next, we'll stick with our cosmic theme here. What happens when black holes collide? Nyla Boodoo talked to the researchers who got to study that rarely observed event in an encore conversation here on the 21st. Stay with us. You're listening to the 21st.
Support for the 21st comes from the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing tomorrow's leaders to be advocates for and agents of social change. More information at socialwork.illinois.edu.
You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. What happens when a pair of black holes 3 billion light years away collide? More than a century ago, Albert Einstein first predicted that such an event would create ripples in the fabric of space and time, known as gravitational waves. It took 100 years before we were finally able to figure out how to observe them, and now a team of researchers from across the world has done it again for only the third time in history. Several of those researchers are from Northwestern University's Astronomy Research Center, and I'm joined on the line now by two of them. Michael Zevin is a PhD candidate in physics and astronomy. Shane Larson is a research associate professor of physics at Northwestern. He's also an astronomer at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. Shane, Michael, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for being here.
Shane, let's start with you. Since we're talking about black holes colliding, I feel like the first thing I need to ask, I think I have a very good sci-fi understanding of black holes, but maybe not a very good real understanding of them. Can you explain what exactly black holes are for everyone?
So I think at zeroth order, the idea that we all have about black holes is the right one, which is it's an object whose gravity is so strong that nothing can get away from them if you fall into the black hole, because in order to get away, you would have to travel faster than the speed of light. And the laws of physics as we know them tell us that that's not possible. So they are objects whose gravity is so strong, they're inescapable.
And Michael, when we think about the idea of black hole collisions, they are some of the most violent and energetic processes in the universe. How big are they? How, in terms of power or energy?
As far as big, black holes can actually be quite tiny. You can have black holes much more massive than the sun that are only 100 or so kilometers across, so much smaller than our planet Earth. But the collisions are monumental events. The problem is that these collisions release so much energy, but none of that energy is expected to be in the form of light, something that we could see with a traditional telescope, so leaving us blind to these cataclysmic events that are happening out there in the cosmos.
And Michael, is that why it's been so hard for us scientists to figure out how to actually observe them?
So black holes have been kind of indirectly observed. We can see how they're affecting systems that are going around them. For example, a star, a black hole could be pulling off material from it and heating it up. So we can see that kind of indirect effect of a black hole in the neighborhood. But being able to detect the collisions of two black holes themselves really requires a different form of information than light. And this is where this big discovery came in of gravitational waves, because they don't emit any light, but they still radiate away these ripples in space.
Shane, can you explain that? Because what does it mean to create a ripple? Like, and I think everyone thinks of, you know, people say, oh, ripple in this fabric of space-time. And again, people have maybe a not clear understanding at all of what that is. What does that mean?
This is the complicated bit about how we think about modern gravity. So Einstein's ideas about gravity, which we call general relativity, and have now been tested for a century and shown to, you know, describe the universe as we see it, he had to really change the way we think about how gravity should be described. You and I, every day we experience gravity by sitting in our chairs and walking on the floors, and we think of it as a force that pulls us straight down to the ground. And in order to develop general relativity, Einstein had to think about it a little differently. He had to invent a completely new way of thinking about it. And what he settled on was this thing today that we describe as the curvature, the warpage, the shape of space and time. And so when we think about gravitational waves, or when we talk about gravitational waves, we're talking about how that curvature, that warpage of space-time, moves from one place in the universe to another. And if you want to reconcile that with the kind of traditional way you think about gravity, as gravity is a force, I think a not correct mathematical way to think about it, but an intuitive way to think about it, is to imagine that you have some object that's making gravity, two black holes going around each other, and if the gravity changes because they're moving with respect to each other, that change has to get from the black holes to you, wherever you're measuring the gravity, say orbiting in your spaceship far away or at LIGO here on Earth. And that change in the gravity moving through the universe is what we're actually trying to measure. But the right way to think about it, the mathematical way we think about it, the way the universe seems to be properly described, is this warpage or this curvature in what we call space-time.
And so, Michael, is it actually observed as a wave, or is it that just a useful analogy for how we should think about it?
So we actually do observe these ripples as waves. And Shane was talking about how anything that has mass or has energy actually curves the space that it's residing in. But once you start to move things, kind of similar if you were to drag your hand through a pond of water, it'll create ripples that kind of propagate away from the system. So when we have accelerating systems, these curvature, these waves kind of ripple away from that system. So what we would detect here on Earth, billions of light years away, are these ripples that were emanating from this system of black holes very far away in the universe.
Yeah, Shane, you mentioned LIGO. That's the detector that's used to observe this. There's two of them, right? And they're really massive. Can you describe what they look like and why do they have to be so big?
Yeah, so LIGO is the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. So this is the premier gravitational observatory in the world. It's the very first one that was finally successfully put together and detected gravitational waves. There are many others that we also partner with that are slowly coming online as time goes on. There are two facilities. There's one in Livingston, Louisiana, northeast of Baton Rouge, and there's one in Hanford, Washington, so just to the west of Tri-Cities in the eastern part of Washington. So the name, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, laser interferometer is the kind of scientific instrument that it is. There are large laser systems where we shine lasers in two directions. They go down these large tunnels that we call the beam tubes. They're 4 kilometers, or about 2.5 miles from the corner out to the end of the arm, and that goes in two directions. So they're shaped like these gigantic 4-kilometer-long L's. And if you go to Google Maps and, you know, type LIGO Hanford or LIGO Livingston, you can see them in the satellite. They're that big. And then the second part, gravitational waves, well, that's what we're trying to detect. And then the O in LIGO, observatory, I always like to tell people is a bit of optimism that we named LIGO in the 1990s before we had ever made a detection, but we always were hoping we'd get to the day we're at today where this is a real kind of astronomy. It's not just an experiment we do once, we write down the answers, you know, hand them in to our middle school science teacher and go off and do something new, right? Astronomy is looking at the universe over and over and over again and seeing new events and different events and trying to understand what the cosmos is all about. So the laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory completely encapsulates what the instrument is, what we're looking for, and what our hopes and aspirations for it as scientists really are. But these are the two here in the United States. There's one coming on in Italy, hopefully by the end of the summer. That's called Virgo. The Japanese, our partners in Japan, are building one in a mine. That's called Kagra. And in the early 2020s, we're expecting there should be a duplicate of LIGO that will come online in India.
That's Shane Larson. He's an astronomer at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. He also is an associate professor of physics at Northwestern University. Shane and Michael Zevin, my other guest, are part of Northwestern's Astronomy Research Center, Sierra. And Michael, part of your work as a graduate student at Northwestern involves improving these detectors. How do you know when a signal that gets picked up is actually a gravitational wave and not some other kind of background noise or energy?
So that's a great question. And the background noise is actually one of the hardest parts about this experiment. And to get an idea of why, it's important to kind of understand how minuscule the signals that we're actually getting from space are. So we have these laser interferometers, but what they're acting as are incredibly precise stopwatches, if you will. So what gravitational waves do when they pass through space is they cause distances to stretch and shrink and stretch and shrink. So when we shoot these lasers down these two equal length arms in this L shape, the lasers race down the arms and come back and meet each other. Now, if the arms are the exact same length, then essentially because of the wave-like nature of light, we will get a signal that disappears in our detectors. But if one of the arms gets a little bit stretched when the other one gets a little bit shrunk, maybe from a passing gravitational wave, for example, then we actually start to see some kind of signal, and this is how we can infer that a gravitational wave is passing through our planet. The problem is these changes in distances that we have to be kind of attuned to detect are about 1,000 times smaller than a proton. So we're stretching this 4-kilometer arm 1,000 times the diameter of a proton. So crazy, crazy, crazy tiny distances. That means that each one of these detectors is really kind of prone to lots of different sources of noise that can kind of give us some kind of energy inside of our detectors. So anything from a strong gust of wind blowing to an earthquake across the world to something within the instrument itself can actually cause these little kind of fluctuations in the length of the arm.
So you mean noises? Yeah, so Michael, you mean noises here on Earth. You don't mean noises.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So one of the big problems is disentangling what is really a gravitational wave signal and what's one of these things that we call noise, one of these things that are affecting the detectors themselves. So one of the big ways that we are able to kind of disentangle the two is having two detectors. So a gravitational wave from space doesn't care about the Earth being there. It'll pass right through our planet and hit both of the detectors very close to the same time. Whereas the noise that we're getting from the environment, for example, is unlikely to be correlated to be the same between the two detectors. But one of the things that we're actively working on at Northwestern is developing a system where we actually look to volunteers, that we call citizen scientists, to look at a lot of this problematic noise and help us classify and characterize this noise in the detectors with the hopes of being able to eliminate it from the detectors and actually make our detectors more sensitive to the true signals coming from space.
So, Michael, you actually, I know that program you're talking about, that's the program called Gravity Spy. Is that the one that any citizen scientist could get involved with?
Yeah, that's right. All you need is a computer or a tablet or a cell phone. You can log on to gravityspy.org, and you'll see images that you're able to classify as different kind of noise features. So there are types of noise that appear in the detectors over and over and over again, and getting a good kind of comprehensive classification of all these different kinds of noise features is going to be really beneficial for both understanding where they come from and eliminating them from the detectors to make them more sensitive. All you have to do to start classifying is actually go on to gravityspy.org, and then you can see real data for yourself and help out with a search for gravitational waves.
Shane, unfortunately, we just have a couple minutes left, but I wonder, it sounds like this is a really exciting time to be an astronomer because this was built long before, like, you know, we've known about this for quite some time. We've had the instruments built. Now we can finally detect them. I wonder what you think is the significance and what we've learned from this most recent wave that was detected.
So the significance, I think, is that this is a completely new and different way of looking at the universe. You know, all of us have kind of grown up looking at pictures and books and magazines and newspaper articles that are of these, you know, amazing places in the cosmos taken with telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope. And all of that information is gathered with light. And this is a completely new and different way of studying all these very interesting astrophysical phenomena. And as astronomers, it's very exciting because it's teaching us about these, you know, phenomena that we're interested in with very complementary and different information than you can learn with telescopes. And so the expectation is that for those of us who have seen the beginnings of gravitational wave astronomy, as well as the students and new scientists coming up behind us who are going to only ever exist as astronomers with gravitational wave data, the things that we're going to know and learn about the universe will be substantially different from what we've learned up to this point. And that's a very exciting way to kind of be involved with science when you're doing it actively every day.
And did we learn anything? Yeah, did we learn anything new from this most recent observation?
Yeah, so, you know, these first three detections by LIGO have been really interesting because they've all been of black holes. And the very first detection and this most recent detection, the black holes have been substantially heavier than the black holes we would normally expect from standard understanding of how stars behave and live their lives and die. They're about twice as heavy as you would expect from talking to your friends who study how stars die when they blow up. And so that's very interesting. There have been a lot of tinkering and theoretical ideas about how and why that's true. And so now as LIGO begins to put more data on the table, especially like this most recent detection we announced where there's, again, a new set of these heavy black holes that we've never observed before, that's really going to help us pin down and understand all of these very interesting ideas we have about where they come from and how many there are in the universe and why they're important. So that's probably the most important thing about these individual discoveries that has us really excited.
One last question. So when a gravitational wave, you detect them or we observe them, does it make any difference to us here on Earth? Like, it's not like we would feel it or anything, would we?
Yeah, so you know, one of the
I know it's kind of a weird question.
To detect is because, you know, as, you know, sensory interfaces with the universe, none of us has built into our five senses a way of detecting these waves that we're talking about. So we didn't even really know they existed till we kind of deduced their existence through this development of modern gravity that Einstein started. And so from that perspective, you know, they're passing through me and you right now, and we don't even know it. But in the end, as with all things in science, you can't know what the important consequences of making these big discoveries are going to be. It's going to change the way we think about the universe. It will change our ideas about stars and where they come from. The technologies that go into LIGO will ultimately filter out into society and be used in strange and unusual ways. You know, all of those things are what the output of science is. But the discovery itself, you know, the most important thing is that it, you know, maintains our curiosity and it keeps us looking and inspires new questions about who we are and where we came from. And that's what's going on right now. In the future, 25 years from now, when you and I have this interview, then we'll know better about, you know, how it helps your golf game or improves your life in your kitchen, right?
Well, that's Shane Larson. He's an astronomer at the Adler Planetarium, a research associate professor of physics at Northwestern University. I want to thank Michael Zevin, who's a PhD candidate in physics and astronomy at Northwestern as well, for explaining this phenomenon to us. Both of them are part of the LIGO scientific collaboration. We're going to tweet out more information about the waves, about Gravity Spy, if you're interested as well. Michael, Shane, thank you. Thanks so much for explaining this for us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Here's a special rebroadcast of a previous episode.
I don't know what to do. I got too much to think about. Doing too much sitting around. Got holes in my pockets, one pair of shoes, but I got all of you.
That's Dan Durley. He's a Chicago singer-songwriter who's gearing up for the release of his debut solo album, Stone Feet. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. Dan is in studio with us now in downtown Chicago, where we're broadcasting from the Mendel Newsroom. Hey, Dan.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me a little bit about this album. How did it come about?
Oh, man. Well, I have been playing in bands and writing songs for, like, all of my life, pretty much. And I just had this batch of songs that kind of needed a treatment outside of a band. They all kind of fit into this narrative that I wanted to put together. And I don't know, it was just something that kind of happened outside of every other project that I was doing. So
right, because you play in two other bands, right? The
yes.
92s, it's based in Champaign-Urbana?
We're all in Chicago. We've been all in Chicago
for a while. Oh, so everybody's kind of in Chicago. And Nice Things is another, right?
Yes.
So what was sort of, when you said there was kind of a narrative, what kind of narrative do you think was forming around your solo album, the solo work?
I think, like, to just be kind of broad about it, just, you know, the problems that everybody faces as they go into, you know, emerging adulthood, and just trying to find your footing, you know, trying to do things with a lack of opportunity to do so, you know, just like
that song we just heard, No Money.
Yeah, just like all,
right?
you know, it's all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've been playing music for most of your life, right? When did you first start picking up? When did you first pick up a guitar?
Yeah. I have been playing guitar since I was six. My dad just kind of put one in my hands, and it's, you know, I've just never stopped, really. So yeah, it's really been present pretty much 100% of my life.
And was that something, did your dad also a musician?
Yeah, yeah. He plays, not professionally, but all the time. Does his open mics and, you know, plays Neil Young songs all the time at, like,
okay,
our kitchen table, just
yeah,
stuff like that. He plays, you know, guitar, does some harmonica, sings a bunch. I think he used to write some stuff, but mostly just kind of does it for fun now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for you, what was the step where you took to not just going from playing, but then to also start writing?
I'm not sure if there was, like, a hard line where it started, but I don't know. Once I was in, like, middle school age, and I realized that it could, like, help me with girls, I think I took it more seriously.
That's great.
And so I just kind of dove headfirst around that time. And all the songs were terrible. Like, my songs, probably, like, up until early college, were really bad.
Okay.
Yeah. But I was, like, very public about them. I would put out
records. Were you very public about how bad they were?
No. Like, I was still putting out, like, public projects. Like, I was playing all the time and, like, taking it very seriously. And, I mean, now I kind of wish that I let things incubate a little bit more. But
interesting. So yeah. How long have you been working on this album then?
I think some of the – there's some songs on this record that are, like, 3 years old. Maybe – well, I guess I made this record in – September of last year, so even older now. It's just kind of a compilation of a bunch of songs over the years that were just kind of left out of other projects that I wanted to fit into this one box.
I'm speaking with Chicago singer-songwriter Dan Durley. Let's take a listen to Song Off Your Full-Length Record. This is one. This is the title track from the album Stone Feed. Let's take a listen to it. Stone Feet, the artist, Dan Durley. He's a Chicago singer-songwriter. He is in studio with me here now, chatting about his music. So, Dan, you went out to L.A. Mm-hmm. to record this. What was that process like, and why'd you do that?
Well, it sounds a little bit more glamorous than it really was. It, you know, like, that's kind of like the romantic notion.
Right,
you
go I go to L.A.
LA, you make your record, you meet all these people. Really, I have been working with the same producer who was Chicago-based for years, since I was, like, 17, for the entirety of my last band's, like, albums. And he just happened to move out to L.A., like, okay. 2 years ago. So I went to his place, and he, like, set up a whole studio there when he moved out there. And he lives with a bunch of other musicians. So it was kind of like I was making a Chicago record. I just happened to be in better weather.
But you chose to also do this on vinyl.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is pretty pricey.
It is, yeah. It's ridiculous, to be honest with you. It's crazy.
So what was the thinking behind that? Especially because it's a solo, like, you're doing this all yourself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think part of it is, like, I know that I'll sell some CDs to people. But, one, this record is really warm. Like, the sound is super warm. And it's got a nice low end to it. I think that it sounds a little bit better on record, number one. And I just kind of wanted to present it in that way, regardless of the cost. And two, like, I don't know. I think that people just are more it's easier to sell that to people, like, at the point of sale, like at
a
show.
From a marketing perspective,
yeah,
you think
definitely.
Also.
Yeah.
Because it's vinyl.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about, because I'm thinking about the song we started with, the Got No Money, and talking about, like, I wonder, do you feel like it's been hard as an artist financially to do what you're doing now?
Yes. It's not easy, per se. Like, I don't think I will ever, at least in the short term, be able to say that, like, I'm making 100% of my money playing my own songs, like, going out and promoting this record and doing all of that, and then also taking a salary. Like, that's hard. I think that's hard for everybody. I think even if you think about a band that you think is big or a songwriter that you think is successful, there's a chance that they're probably, like, at the poverty line. It's really what the reality is. And I don't know. I think everybody just has to temper their expectations if they want to do this, number one, and just, I don't know, find creative sources of income. I'm playing in, like, this really crazy party cover band right now, too.
As a source of income, so you can do this other stuff, too.
Exactly, yeah. And sometimes I drive for Uber. I do, like, all sorts of different – I do, like, four or five different things for money right
now. That said, sort of when you say temper your expectations, what's – do you have, like, a goal, or what's sort of your sense of where you want to be with all of this?
I honestly just – I love songwriting. I love making records. Even, like, below that, I love playing live. I like it all, but truly I want to see myself as a songwriter primarily and hopefully make – have that be just, I don't even want to say primary source of income. I just want to say, like, how I spend the most amount of my time.
Mm-hmm. And is writing songs for other people or for yourself?
It could be anything. Honestly, like, I'm open to the idea of some songwriting for hire type situations. That's kind of what I romanticize, is, like, you know, producing and songwriting and all that.
And do you feel like the way the industry is now, is it harder to distinguish yourself because there's so many people out there who are self-publishing and doing kind of their own thing?
Yeah, I think it's less about, like, trying to distinguish yourself from others, because I think, like, if you're talking to other songwriters or whatever, no one's seeing it as, like, a competition. Mm-hmm. They're trying to, like, separate themselves from some other pack of artists. You know, like, I don't know people that necessarily think in that way, but I know that just trying to break through the noise, there's just, like, so many gatekeepers that you gotta get through to impress, to get, like, that blog feature or, you know, anything like that. And there's even, like, an entire industry set up around it. You can, like, pay promoters thousands of dollars to do it. All of that. And it's really difficult, you know, and you got to make some hard choices about where you spend your resources and your time and all that. That's kind of the new challenge.
So what's your philosophy of that?
I think it's just, like, throwing stuff at the wall until something sticks, really. It's really hard because there's not really one singular path to success anymore. There's, like, you can try to make some sort of narrative about how to be successful, and there's 10 other artists that have done it some other way. So it's really hard to – I just keep on trying until I figure something out.
Hey, thanks for talking to me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's end today's program listening to one more song off your upcoming self-titled release. This is Dan Dorley. It's called Up All Night.
Take your pill, please. Slip into domestic ease. Don't you never wanna leave? Please don't leave. Oh, please. But I'm up all night again, running circles. Stitch sleep.
That does it for us today. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.